John McCain was first elected to the U.S. Senate in 1986. Now he's hoping Arizona voters will send him back 30 years later. I'm Mark Brody. On today's Here and Now, Arizona's senior senator says he's running for a sixth term. Also, state lawmakers wrapped up their session in record time. We'll take a look at what got done and which bills are still waiting for action by Governor Ducey. Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton is delivering his State of the City address today. We'll have a preview. What if libraries loaned out scientific tools as well as books? Some groups are trying to make that happen in an effort to crowdsource research. And we step into the Wayback Machine and travel to the middle of the last century for Modern Phoenix Week. Three martini lunch optional. That and more coming up on KJZZ's Here and Now after a check of this hour's news. Morning, it's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix, in for Steve Goldstein. Later this hour, a new approach to getting scientific results and the mid-century celebration that is Modern Phoenix Week. But first, Arizona Senator John McCain says he's running for a sixth term. His announcement yesterday had been widely expected.
I think that I have done a lot, and there's a lot more for me to do, as this nation is probably in more danger than at any time since the end of World War II.
The last time he ran, McCain easily won the Republican primary against J.D. Hayworth before defeating Democrat Rodney Glassman in November. And many observers are expecting Arizona's senior senator to face a primary challenge this year as well. But McCain says he's not too worried about that.
I expect, as in every election campaign, a tough fight. I've never minded a good fight, and I will look forward to another one if it's necessary.
Joining me now to talk about all that is Marcus Dellartino. He's a partner at First Strategic Communications and Public Affairs here in Phoenix and has worked on McCain campaigns in the past. Marcus, welcome.
Great. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Was there any doubt in your mind at any point that McCain would run for another term?
Absolutely none. My joke is, what's John going to do? Go play golf? And and that, of course, inferring his both his arms could get the golf club back. There's absolutely no doubt John was going to run, and he's perfect. He's greatly positioned for the state of Arizona. I mean, the Armed Services Chairman, wow. That's a big deal for Arizona, big win. We can protect the A-10 Thunderbolt down in Tucson and do a whole vast great things with the Arizona economy and the defense contractors.
What are you hearing about potential challengers, both in a Republican primary and in a general election?
Sure, sort of an interesting dynamic. I mean, I think that State Senator Kelly Ward is interested in running in the primary, as well as Matt Salmon. And the two of them have sort of been sitting on the sidelines waiting to see who flinches first and who's going to get into this race. And so that's been sort of a interesting dynamic. That helps McCain, of course. The longer they wait, it's the more money he can raise and get positioned and get his message out. So we'll have to see. You know, they're running out of time here. A decision's going to have to be made here shortly between the two of them. And then, of course, in the general election, we'll see who they put up. I know Rodney Glassman months ago had indicated he'd like to run again on the Democratic side. So we'll have to see if he decides to make that decision.
Do you think there's any chance that Congressman Salmon actually leaves what is a very safe seat in the East Valley to run a primary against a very well-funded, everybody knows who he is, incumbent?
I think there's a chance, but you have to take, I mean, you bring up a great point. I mean, it's a safe seat. It's a great seat. There's not a huge amount of travel distance. What people need to realize is once you run for Senate, your district is not just the city of Mesa, it's the entire state of Arizona. And as John mentioned yesterday, he's visited literally every town and city in the entire state of Arizona. So your travel schedule is brutal. And that affects, of course, your family life. And so you need to take all these things into consideration with your family before making a decision like this.
How do you think the 2016 John McCain campaign will be similar and different to previous John McCain campaigns?
Well, certainly it'll be similar in that you're going to not be able to turn on your TV for more than 10 seconds without seeing a TV spot by John McCain. And I expect him to raise a lot of money, and that'll be the primary challenge for his challengers. I think it'll be different in the sense of, and he hit upon this a little bit yesterday. He's going to talk about, water being a big issue for Arizona. And for those natives in Arizona, you know that water's always been our primary issue. I think, as we like to say, in Arizona, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. And that it will also talk about, you know, he mentioned fire, and he'll talk about the fire dangers up north. And certainly, as we've seen in recent years, it continues to get worse and worse with our forest health. But he'll also be talking about national security. And again, as Armed Services Chairman, I think he's the go-to guy, frankly, from the Republican Party to talk about national security. He's predicted, frankly, all these world issues that that have come up, you know, ISIS, Afghanistan, Iraq, the list goes on and on. So,
with someone like John McCain, who, as we talked about, pretty much everybody in the state knows who he is, he's run for president, he's been in office for decades now. Do voters look at his record, let's say, over the last term, over his last 6 years, or do voters already sort of have an idea of what they think about John McCain from whenever, and that's sort of the opinion they have of him?
Yeah, I mean, interesting. You're right. Nobody in Arizona doesn't know who John McCain is unless you just happen to move here and you're about 12 years old. But most every Arizonian's got about 100% name ID or 99% name ID. So, you know, most people have, and frankly, most people have seen him at a town hall in Arizona or met him at the coffee shop or whatever it may be and have their own personal experiences of John McCain. So he's difficult to define in just 6 years, 4 years, 2 years because of his longstanding career and his being in Arizona so long. And I think that that's what the voters will look at more. And I will tell you, you know, honestly, his polling numbers are pretty good right now. And so I think that that's another thing his challengers need to take into account. Is it worth, you know, potentially giving up my congressional seat or my state senate seat or whatever other elected job I have when John's numbers are pretty good and he's going to raise a whole lot of money?
Do you think his age is a factor in this race?
You know, I don't, and that's one from personal experience. And I'll tell you, I'm obviously a lot younger than John is. And I will tell you, he has more energy than I do. And maybe it's because, you know, I'm a first-time parent and I'm exhausted all the time. But I will tell you, the energy on this man is like nothing you've ever seen before. And most of his contemporaries, frankly, all of them, can't compete with his energy level, number one. And number two, we've seen this argument before during the presidential campaign. We talked about age. And I'll just remind voters, you know, Joe Arpaio's no spring chicken either, but they continue to vote for Joe Arpaio. And so, I think it'll get brought up, but it when voters are actually looking at their ballot, it won't be their primary decision point.
Let's switch gears a little bit from the federal lawmakers to state lawmakers. You were at the Capitol for all of the fun that was the Sine Die Night last Thursday night into Friday morning. This was a session that ended in record speed. What do you make of all of that, of what happened during the session, the speed at which it went, how quickly things happen, sort of the compact nature of voting and debating bills?
Yeah, it was, it was a record-setting pace. We got out in 82 days, and we certainly haven't done that in the state of Arizona in a long time. And that comes with pluses and minuses. The pluses are that we get done faster and people's liberties are safer if you can get it done on a faster schedule. But there's also things where you tend to leave a lot of issues still on the table unresolved. And frankly, there's bills that could have used a little bit more debate or a little bit more detail in which a 120-day calendar might afford or a 100-day calendar even might afford. So although it's helpful, it keeps the budget fights down to a minimum. I would argue that it also leaves a lot to be there's a lot left to be done, and we might be looking at special sessions.
I was going to ask you about that. Are there particular issues that you think didn't get done in the session and might require lawmakers to come back for some amount of time over the summer?
Well, certainly in the final hours, I was personally predicting we'd probably be back in special session to do the real ID bill. And fortunately for all Arizonans, that bill got out in the final moments of legislative session, and that would have been a required special session. But I think that there are some priorities that the governor is going to have that he might want to get done before session, and he might be looking to work, and you know, his Inspector General bill I know is important to him, and he might be looking to do a special session on that. CPS is always going to be an issue in Arizona. We're going to have to see how this whole thing sort of fetters out with new leadership over there and see if there's some last-minute fixes we need to do there.
Was there a theme to this year's session? I mean, in past sessions, like Medicaid expansion has sort of been the theme, or the budget has been the theme. Was there a theme in your mind this year?
I think to the extent there was a theme, and that, you know, is debatable, I'm not too sure it was a solid message, but I think that the message was probably fiscal accountability. And what, at least what the president and the governor and the speaker wanted to accomplish is get us on a budget track that is fiscally responsible and a balanced budget long term. And Arizona's frankly been struggling for that for quite a long time. You and I both know we are very dependent on the home building industry here and growth. That was certainly a problem during a recession, and it wreaked havoc, as we've seen in our budget, both short-term and long-term. So what their goal was is to try and fix this for the long-term.
There are a number of bills that are on the governor's desk waiting for him to take action. He's got 10 days from the end of session. Some of the notable ones, at least to me, include raising campaign contribution limits, prohibiting state money to be used for the Affordable Care Act, allowing, if you get a moving violation when you're driving, go to driver school more quickly. Are there particular bills that you're really paying attention to see what the governor does with them, either because it'll set a signal of something that he believes in, or just it's a particularly important or interesting policy that the state could be dealing with?
Well, I think, you know, probably some of the more interesting ones you've already mentioned, and I would add probably the Uber-Lyft fight. I'm sure your younger audience members are probably thrilled to hear that bill. And I think that's still on the governor's desk, waiting to be signed, but certainly expected to be signed. It was not a session, I would say, that one single bill captivated the message points. I would say that there was a series of smaller bills that may lead up to, you know, what message point the governor would say was independent freedom, more liberties. The microbrewery bill certainly started out to be probably the biggest bill of the legislative session, and compromise was reached rather quickly, and it turned into something sort of boring at the end of the day.
Marcus Dellartino is a partner at First Strategic Communications and Public Affairs here in Phoenix. Marcus, thanks.
Thank you.
Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton is delivering his annual State of the City address today. Phoenix is facing an uncertain fiscal future. There's another community budget hearing tonight at the Paradise Valley Community Center. I spoke with Mayor Stanton earlier in advance of his speech and asked him about the state of his city.
The city of Phoenix is doing great. You know, just 4 years ago when I took over as mayor, we were just beginning to get out of the economic doldrums. We had a very, very difficult budget situation. Today, things are looking great in the city of Phoenix. Obviously, you see the signs of economic growth, economic activity all over the city, particularly in the urban core where there's just so much excitement happening. So in this speech, we'll have some very exciting announcements about some great new jobs that are coming to our city. We've got a balanced budget. We're moving forward with an innovative export-based economy. We understand what it takes to compete in this new, increasingly competitive international economy, and that's exactly what I've tried to do as mayor, is take the city of Phoenix where it needs to go so we can be as competitive as possible.
One of the issues that the city is facing, though, you mentioned good economic times, there are some economic potential warning spots down the road. The city manager has talked about deficits in coming fiscal years. How concerned are you about those?
Well, we got to roll up our sleeves and get to work just like we've done. In fact, if you were to ask me that same question 2 years ago, we would have suggested that there might be a budget deficit this year of $30 million. We got to work. We rolled up our sleeves, made smart choices. We made some cuts. We eliminated positions. We've done pension reform. And this year, we have a balanced budget. So Phoenix is no stranger to having to make tough choices to advance our budget in the right ways. But there's a reason why Phoenix has the highest credit rating of any big city in the country. It's not because we are not a fiscally well-managed city, just the opposite. We have a strong and long and proud tradition of being fiscally well-managed, and that's certainly going to continue during my time as mayor. So, yes, I'm aware that there are projected deficits in the future, and that's exactly why we get to work, roll up our sleeves, and work on solving it.
With the end of the emergency food tax just recently, I mean, do you expect that there is the possibility of having more revenue down the road, or do you think if there is a deficit that it'll have to be largely fixed through cuts and other things?
Well, I want to prejudge that decision. All I know is that as mayor, we are doing great from an economic perspective. Things are heading in the right direction, and we've been able to do it by making tough budget decisions and accepting the fact that the food tax is not going to be there. So I don't want to prejudge any of the decisions that might have to be made next year in order to balance the budget. As mayor, as a strong leader, you make the tough choices, the right choices to move the city forward. Look, we are moving forward this year with the transportation plan that I know we're going to talk about, and it's an investment in infrastructure in the city. I know for us, for this city to advance, for our community to advance, we've got to invest in infrastructure, and that's exactly what the people of Phoenix will have an opportunity to do this August.
Do you expect to have to do more work to deal with city pensions?
Yes, and in fact, we've done a lot of work already, and the work that we, when I say we, I mean not only the mayor and council, but the people of the city of Phoenix have done. We have saved over $830 million over 25 years. We've ended pension spiking in the city of Phoenix. Now we've got a new pension reform going to the ballot, which is going to be even better for the taxpayer, saving an additional $38 million, eliminating pensions for those at the very top of a certain income level. So we're not going to have any of these big announcements where people retire from the city and earn a pension amount that shocks the conscience. You're not going to see that anymore. So we're going to have a smart and fair retirement system, fair to the employees and fair to the taxpayers of Phoenix. And so that's what this pension reform is about in August.
When you look at the recently ended legislative session, I'm curious, in your mind, how was it for cities in general and your city specifically?
Well, look, I respected the work that our friends at the legislature have to do. But they should never balance their budget on the backs of cities. We are independent governmental entities, and so we got hit pretty hard, and so it was not a very pleasant thing to have happen. It's not really fair. I really believe that we should work as a partnership, and not have fiscal decisions at the state be done in a way where we have to pay money for services that were used to be paid for by the state. But I'm always going to look for ways to work closely with the state and the governor's office on economic development to bring jobs to our community. So that's going to be my focus moving forward.
Was there one particular or maybe two particular things that lawmakers and the governor did that are particularly tough for Phoenix?
Well, the impact of the state budget on the city of Phoenix was about $6.5 million. And we are just getting out from underneath the impact of this horrible recession that has happened in our community. And we need to start reinvesting in this city. We need more police officers, more firefighters, longer library hours, more opportunity for youth to play at youth centers and at our parks. So anytime a decision they make impacts our budget in a negative way, I really don't think it's what the people of Phoenix would like, because I really believe that they want those key services that the city provides. So they made a couple decisions which negatively impacted our budget, and obviously as mayor it's frustrating. But again, I'm looking forward. I always look forward, and I want to work with the state of Arizona on all the job creation activity we possibly can do.
You mentioned infrastructure and transportation, and I'm curious how big of a deal you think some of the light rail extensions are going to be for Phoenix, and sort of even the idea of them have been for Phoenix.
Well, first off, light rail has been a huge success in the city of Phoenix. I mean, I know some people want to make the same old tired arguments from 15 years ago about light rail. I'm telling you, 35,000 jobs have been created along the light rail, $5 billion of investment just in Phoenix along the light rail line. It's way surpassed our expectations. If you believe in education like I do, you know that light rail, one of four passengers, is a student. I mean, education and public transportation go hand in hand. And what we're going to do when the voters pass our transportation, Move Phoenix is the name of the plan, when the voters of Phoenix pass Move Phoenix in August, it's going to be a game changer, bringing light rail to South Phoenix and to Maryvale and up to Metro Center and Northeast Phoenix, significantly increasing bus service, providing mobility help for those with disabilities and seniors that can't drive themselves. That's literally a life changer for those individuals. Biking is so important in our community. We have to be a more bikeable city to be a more competitive city. We had 1,000 miles of bike lane and bus rapid transit, which is so popular in North Phoenix and in Ahwatukee foothills. This is a comprehensive plan. It's bold, it's ambitious, and I am super excited that the people of Phoenix are going to have the opportunity to vote on this, and I know that they're going to support infrastructure, knowing that for a great city, you got to have great infrastructure, and to advance your economy, you got to invest in yourselves.
There's been a lot of talk about all the development, the economic development that's gone on along the light rail line, both the existing one and some of the planned future ones. Do you think that it's a fair statement to say that some majority or most of the development that's going on in Phoenix is along light rail? Is there stuff going on away from the rail?
Sure. You look at the Discovery Triangle. You look at activity near Sky Harbor Airport. You look at what I'm going to make some major announcements tomorrow in areas up in North Phoenix. So there's economic activity going all around the city. But yes, there is no doubt that the light rail spurs significant economic activity. And, you know, what we invested in 15 years ago, the light rail system that's there now that goes from Phoenix to Tempe and to Mesa, that's just the backbone of the system. It has to become eventually a true regional system. And that's why we got to continue to invest. We got to continue to build infrastructure to advance this city. By we're going to connect through light rail in this election, ASU Tempe, ASU Downtown, Grand Canyon University, ASU West, higher education and transportation go hand in hand. And how many students use public transportation to get to and from their schools every single day? So it's an incredible opportunity. It takes buildings in Midtown and Downtown that have been partially or mostly vacant for a long period of time now and breathes new life into them, makes them more relevant again. Tech companies want to be along the light rail. Look at where the incubators and the accelerators are going in this community, the co-working spaces. It's along the light rail line. People want to be along that line. It's where the millennials that we're trying to retain and attract most want to be, live a more urban lifestyle. So having a great public transportation system adds so much value to our community. It makes us more competitive in this increasingly competitive international economy. It is not a nice thing to have. It's a must-have if you're going to advance your city.
If I could ask you to look into your crystal ball for just a second, if you and I have this conversation next year, what do you think the state of Phoenix will be next year, and what will be maybe a couple of the big issues that you'll be talking about next year?
Well, obviously, it's going to be the same. Still continuing to build an innovative economy, still creating a more export-based economy. We haven't had a chance to talk about that, but the cities that have the highest percentage of their economy based upon exporting, those are the cities with the highest wages, with the highest educated workforce. Phoenix has got to catch up to those cities. Our proximity to Mexico is one of our greatest strategic advantages. I, as mayor, have tried to stand for the proposition that we need to actively be involved in the international economy. And so I've tried to talk the talk and walk the walk, both in terms of opening the Mexico City Trade Office, making numerous trade missions, leading numerous trade missions myself, but to creating the Export Readiness Initiative. And we're going to have a regional export plan that's announced next month. In terms of building an innovative economy, we are in the talent business. This is why we offer the great services that we do at the city, so we can retain our most talented people and we can attract the most talented people from around the country and the world who want to come to live in this spectacular locale that we are blessed to live in. Do we have those technological jobs? Do we have the workforce that they need? Do we have an economy rooted in innovation, not growth for growth's sake, but in innovation? That's what we're building here in Phoenix. And so as long as I'm mayor for the next 5 years, that's exactly what I'm going to be leading on.
It sounds like you're fairly optimistic about getting another term then, if you're talking about 5 years.
Well, I'm running. I'm in it. I love it. This is the best job in politics, to lead a city of the size of Phoenix and to really have the opportunity to move it in the right direction, to advance an economy, change lives for the next few generations. What other job would I want?
Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton. Mr. Mayor, thanks so much.
Thanks for talking to me.
And a quick news update for you. Johar Tsarnaev has been convicted in the 2013 bombing of the Boston Marathon. A federal jury found Tsarnaev guilty this morning in the 2013 terror attack that killed three people and wounded more than 260. The jury will now decide whether the 21-year-old former college student should be sentenced to death or receive life in prison. Again, Johar Tsarnaev convicted in the 2013 bombing of the Boston Marathon earlier this hour. Still to come on Here and Now, bringing scientific research outside traditional labs, and we'll step back in time for Modern Phoenix Week. That and more is ahead as Here and Now continues.
KJZZ is supported by El Encanto, providing the sight, sounds, and taste of Mexico for 25 years, with restaurants in Cave Creek, Desert Hills, and Fountain Hills, lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch, weddings, and large events. ElEncantoRestaurants.com.
Good morning. This is KJZZ at 91.5, and you're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. KJZZ reporters are also public radio listeners. For the next few weeks, a KJZZ staff member will pick their favorite Morning Edition story and share it with you. You can see what others are listening to by visiting KJZZ.org and click on the I Like This Story or visit KJZZ's Facebook page. We should reach a high of 79 today. This evening, with some light winds and clear skies, temps should dip down to 54 degrees. And for tomorrow, expect high temperatures to reach 82 and sunny. Around the state, it's 71 in Tucson, 48 and windy in Flagstaff, and with sunny skies and calm winds, it's 71 degrees in Phoenix at 11:30.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. For a lot of people, taking part in science experiments ends after their last science fair, but there are people working to change that. One of them is Darlene Cavalier. She's a professor of practice at ASU's Center for Engagement and Training in Science and Society, and the founder of the website Science Cheerleader and SciStarter, which helps facilitate citizen science research projects. Darlene, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So when we talk about citizen science research projects, what are we talking about?
We're talking about a wide array of projects. Some are community-based, so these are concerned citizens looking to crowdsource opportunities for other people to gather evidence for them in the form of data. And we're talking about professional researchers from government labs or academia or industry looking for the same thing, many hands to help them advance their area of research.
It sounds like we're not really just talking about, hey, I want to help my kid build a model volcano or something like that.
We're not talking about that at all, in fact. There are plenty of websites for that, and that's great. We really look for crowdsourcing projects that give people the opportunity to advance areas of science while doing science and learning from that experience as well, perhaps even drawing upon their own conclusions and maybe even starting their own research project.
Do you find that the people who try to do these things have some kind of background in science, or is it people who are just kind of interested in it?
All over the map, as diverse as the topics are for citizen science and the levels of engagement, so too are the interests of the people and the experiences that they bring to this.
So what kinds of projects have you seen people try to do or maybe that you've helped folks work on?
We have one that we are still in the midst of, although the crowdsourcing aspect of it has closed, and this is to collect microbes from all over the country, microbes from shoes and cell phones, microbes from surface areas, as diverse as the 76ers basketball stadium to the crack of the Liberty Bell. And we did this with the University of California Davis's Eisen Lab and the Science Cheerleaders and the SciStarter community, asking people to help us collect these microbes. 48 were selected to fly on the International Space Station, where they were measured for their growth rate analysis. So we compared how healthy microbes grow in space compared to their counterparts here on Earth. We did this to compare the types of microbes that live in a very controlled environment like the International Space Station. What does that look like when you put that up against something like the 76ers Stadium? And then we also did this to start to build out something called the Earth Microbiome Map, where all the data is sequenced, dumped into this map, and it's open. So it's open for people not just to be able to see, you know, what types of microbes are here in Philadelphia, for example, where I'm based, but also to be able to compare that to other sources of data. Will we someday get to a point where we have enough data where we can start to draw conclusions? For example, boy, I see a lot of this type of bacteria here in Philadelphia, and I wonder if that correlates to a rise in flu outbreaks or autism or whatever the other disease or condition might be.
When you talk about crowdsourcing something that in many cases is fairly complex, some of these science experiments, do you require or hope that the people who are working on this remotely have some kind of background or knowledge and aren't just sort of throwing stuff up against the wall to see what sticks?
They're never really asked to throw stuff against the wall to see what sticks. And I actually hope that they come from an area of expertise that is outside of the realm of what that researcher's area of expertise is in, because we have seen time and time again, and there's plenty of literature to support this, that oftentimes it's people who do not have the tunnel vision who come up with new observations and tend to look at things in ways that move things forward a little bit more quickly. So most of the citizen science projects are tiered, or they are just single step. So it's one direction, one thing that you're being asked to do. And in the case of the microbes, it's collect microbes, follow the instructions, use the sterilized Q-tips, collect microbes, put them in the barcoded Ziploc bags, and send them back to us. That was one chunk of it. The next layer of that may be asking people with different skills and interests to analyze the data that we found, to start to look for those patterns. It's a very different skill set and probably a totally different demographic of people who would be involved in that. But for the most part, many projects chunk out the tasks for people. That said, there are do-it-yourself bio groups, and there are many community-organized groups where it's just a lot of people coming together to explore a question that's of interest to them and not letting anything get in the way of them finding that answer, not even the access to the tools and the instruments. They're finding new ways to just build low-cost instruments and sensors and all kinds of things to make that what would have been a dream or a fantasy in not too many years ago an actual reality now.
I wanted to ask you about access to equipment, because it seems like some of the stuff might be fairly expensive, and you know, if you're only going to use it once or twice, it might not be worth it to invest in that, or maybe you don't even have the ability to invest in it. Are there places where people can rent this stuff out, like a library book kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. We just announced through a White House press release that Arizona State University and SciStarter, the Boston Museum of Science, and an organization called Public Lab are now, and a group called My Turn, are now looking at ways that we can use the SciStarter infrastructure. So right now we serve up projects, and they're pretty well cataloged, and we use a certain taxonomy that helps you find a project that would be of interest to you and that's close to you. Along with that, we'll start to serve up recommended and required gear, so the types of instruments that are required to do that project. And the option will be for you to borrow that instrument and or to buy that instrument. So we will be working with lending libraries where people can just give it a shot. They can test out the instrument, see if they're comfortable with them. If they want to, they can then purchase it. If not, they would return it to that lending library.
Is there a hope, sort of looking at the larger picture here, that by engaging more people in these kinds of projects, that you sort of maybe demystify science somewhat, or get more people involved, even recreationally, in things that are more related to science?
Yes, although our goal isn't so much, our goal is more about empowering people, providing, making it much easier for them if they have the curiosity, if they have the desire to do more, with or without a formal science degree, we want to make it possible for them to do that. So that is our entire goal, is to just make it easier for people to learn about the opportunities to get involved in these projects and get the access to the necessary tools and resources that can help support their experience in this.
Darlene Cavalier is professor of practice at ASU's Center for Engagement and Training in Science and Society. She's also the founder of the website Science Cheerleader and SciStarter. Darlene, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
One of the groups Cavalier mentioned is Public Lab, and I'm joined now by the group's data ambassador, Gretchen Gerke. Gretchen, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So, in your mind, what are the benefits of essentially crowdsourcing scientific research?
Well, one of the major benefits is just that it actually expedites scientific research in many ways. We were founded out of the BP oil spill, or when people came together surrounding the BP oil spill because of a lack of information that was available. There was a bit of a media blackout, and people just didn't know what was happening with this oil spill. Was oil spreading to their beaches? And so because people had, you know, basically we partnered with a bunch of communities, both with open technology tool development communities, and then also with local communities, and put scientific tools in the hands of communities with local knowledge, and they were able to go out and canvas their own areas and monitor their beaches. It really expedited the information that was able to be distributed about that. You know, they didn't have to wait around for a government or academic or media coverage. They were able to learn that information themselves and distribute it themselves. And so that's one of the major benefits. And the other is kind of what you were just talking about with Darlene, about taking some of the mystery away from science and kind of breaking down some of those walls. Sometimes there's that ivory tower of what's going on in the world of academia, when really it's something that we all can do, and we all live in this environment, and so it's great for us all to be able to get our hands on it and understand and learn more about our environment.
I'm interested to hear you say that it can really expedite the process, and I wonder if for that to be the case, you sort of have to assume a baseline of knowledge among the sort of the citizen scientists, that these are people who actually have some semblance of knowledge about what they're doing, as opposed to people who are just given a bunch of tools and said, here, go try doing this.
Well, yes, I agree. But one of the things is that education is a component of this, but really with public lab, it's not just about tools and getting tools into the hands of people. It's about joining an open science community. And so we support communities through kind of what we like to call the whole data life cycle, from identifying a concern. You know, people come saying, like, you know, we're getting sick, or like we've seen illegal discharges, or, you know, they know there's a problem. But we can support them through education, through, you know, through training, and then also through just like collectively gathering a lot of local experts with just different kinds of expertise, technical expertise, but also local knowledge, to come together and kind of support the whole process from, here are our tools, this is how to use them, this is how to collect valid data, and we're working together to design field studies, and then also move it forward with, well, now that we have data, what can we do with it, what differences can we make, how can we advocate for change? So it's not just about, here's a tool, it's the whole process. And really importantly, it's about joining a community where you can talk and problem solve and collaborate with just so many other people through this kind of open platform.
Are the projects that your group is working on ones that you have identified, or people in their individual communities have identified, some combination of those?
Great question. It is what people in their communities have identified. We're not an organization that wants to swoop in and say, oh, hey, you have this problem. It's really communities that have self-identified concerns come to us, and we kind of, we're a resource to communities because we have these kind of two branches kind of, but they, you know, the goal is that they overlap as much as possible, with open technology enthusiasts, you know, do-it-yourself enthusiasts that collaborate through the public lab platform for just, you know, low cost, open source, open technology, open hardware, open software tools, and also these local communities with environmental concerns that are really impacting their local environments. And so we basically like serve as a resource to all of these communities and to get them to collaborate in order to really make some difference in the environmental world. But yes, it's not anything that we've identified. It's really communities that come to us and we help support them.
Have you found over the course of doing this any pitfalls, any problems that you run into, either logistical or otherwise?
I mean, it's difficult. You know, I guess one thing is, so you were talking about lending libraries, and that concept of a sharing economy and a lending library has been central to the model of public lab from the beginning. Back in 2010 with the BP oil spill, we only had 3 aerial mapping kits that we used, and, you know, we borrowed and lent and used in Louisiana, Florida, Alabama, and Mississippi. And so, you know, that culture of sharing was implicit to all of that. And importantly, the data sharing, that is huge. But as we've developed more tools, some of which, you know, require calibration and are, you know, a bit more finicky and all that, and more people want to utilize tools, we have realized that we need to formalize that structure a bit more to increase our capacity for more and more communities to be involved, both because of the type of tool and also just like the size of the community. So that's one logistical area, I guess.
Gretchen Gerke is Data Ambassador for Public Lab. Gretchen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And a quick news update from the KJZZ newsroom. Johar Tsarnaev was convicted earlier this hour in the Boston Marathon bombing by a federal jury. He was found guilty on all 30 counts, 17 of which carry the death penalty. The jury now has to decide whether the 21-year-old former college student should be executed or spend the rest of his life in prison. Again, Johar Tsarnaev convicted this hour in the Boston Marathon bombing by a federal jury. Still to come, we take the long view on Central Avenue and bust out our fedoras for Modern Phoenix Week. That's when Here and Now continues.
KJZZ is supported by Mountain States Employers Council, providing businesses with HR support and employment law assistance, focusing on critical matters such as hiring and firing, workplace harassment, and the Affordable Care Act, msec.org.
This is KJZZ, your community news station, and you're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. Coming up at noon, the city of Ferguson elects new city council members, and we'll hear from newly elected council member Wesley Ferguson about the next steps for the city. Also, traditional Hawaiian music has been around for decades, but it's having a renaissance thanks to young artists. Those stories and more coming up in about 20 minutes on Here and Now from NPR. And checking Valley freeways, the traffic lights at 35th Avenue and I-10 are not working properly. Use caution in that intersection. We should reach a high of 79 today. This evening, some light winds and clear skies, and temps dipping down to 54 degrees for tomorrow. High temperatures around 82. Right now, with sunny skies and some light winds, it's 71 degrees in Phoenix at 11:46.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Over the past few weeks, we've been bringing you stories from along Central Avenue in our series, Central. We've been driving along the roadway from South Mountain to North Mountain, meeting people who live and work in the neighborhoods that line the street. Today, a different perspective on Central, namely the road as a whole and its history. To provide it, I'm joined by Robert Pala, a columnist for Phoenix New Times. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Mark.
So when you think of Central Avenue, sort of this long stretch of roadway in Phoenix, for you, what comes to mind?
Central is like a travelogue of Phoenix now and then. And it's also about my life growing up here. But I think that there are two things about it that even people who didn't grow up here can share. One of them is it's a street that we all end up having a relationship with, because something that you go to often is on Central, or you use it to get to some other place. But also, if you're not from here and you want to know what Phoenix was like, or if you want to see where it's going, you drive up and down Central, because it's kind of a mini education about who we were and who we are and where we are likely going.
So what do you think we can learn about where we've been by being on Central?
I like to drive Central between Sunny Slope, which is right around Dunlap, and downtown. I live right around McDowell and Central. So if you start on the Dunlap end, the Sunny Slope end of Central, you're looking at what Phoenix really looked, a lot of Phoenix looked like, both residentially and commercially in the 60s, because the architectures, a lot of the architectures is from the 60s. And also because there are storefronts on Central in Sunny Slope that are very, very unchanged from 50 years ago. And all the way down Central, you see glimmers of the past. It just really is an architectural travelogue.
So how do you see it as far as a look at where Phoenix is going?
Light rail. Hmm. You're driving down Central and all of a sudden there's a train. And for those of us who've been here a long time, that never... It's like when it rains here and you look outside and everyone's standing on their front porch because there's
watching
water.
It.
Yeah, that's what light rail is like for those of us who've been here. It's like, wow, there's a train.
I hear a lot from folks who grew up here about this concept of cruising on Central, that people would, you know, mostly teenagers would, you know, roll the windows down, crank up the radio and just sort of drive really, really slowly down Central Avenue. Is that something that you ever did?
I did it once.
Just once?
I did it once. I had a friend who went to Central High School. And cruising Central, I think, was just big in the 70s. And it's kind of sad because that really was all there was to do on Friday and Saturday night. And eventually the city shut it down. They figured out some way to get us all the heck off of Central. But I lived in the suburbs, so cruising Central would have meant seeing a lot of strangers from rival high schools. So what we used to do was we used to cruise Metro Center, which is even more sad.
That seems less cool than cruising Central.
It is, but the suburbs were less cool than in-town was. We drove round and round in circles in 1978 in a shopping mall in the suburbs.
Where do you see Central going? What changes do you envision happening along that road going forward?
I see mostly, and this is me making a hopefully educated guess, I see a lot of overlays rather than a lot of teardowns. But because Central has such an unusual personality, there's residential, and then 100 yards later, there's a strip mall from 1958, and then there's a gated community, and then there's three giant houses. It's very hard to say how or where those overlays would take place. But I think rather than ripping things down on Central, developers are more likely to buy existing properties and repair them. You could really see architectural history then and now driving up and down Central. And it's really the best street to do that with anywhere in Phoenix. You can do that with any number of main thoroughfares in the city, but Central is the one that really cuts through generations of development and redevelopment and still shows you examples of each of those.
It seems like not only does it sort of cut through different levels of development, but there's so many different kinds of neighborhoods. You've alluded to, you know, gated communities, strip malls. You have sort of the dense downtown and midtown areas. As somebody who grew up here, is that just something that you're used to, that this one street can be so vastly different over not that big of a geographical territory?
That's true of Phoenix in general. If you look at most of the historic neighborhoods downtown, you will find a Tudor next to an Italianette, next to a California Craftsman, because most of the larger houses downtown were not part of a development. And Central is like that. So you will see those gated communities right next to a strip mall with a new and very popular restaurant in it, next to a travel agency that's been there since the 50s. So it's microcosmic in that way, because all of Phoenix is like that.
Robert Pala is a columnist for Phoenix New Times. Robert, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
By the way, you can hear the last two segments in our series, Central, tomorrow and Friday afternoon on the show. That's at 2 o'clock. There's also a ton of extras, including photos, interactive maps, and more audio at kjzzcentral.tumblr.com. Friday kicks off the 11th Modern Phoenix Week, a celebration of all things mid-century modern in the Valley. It includes tours, talks, and presumably a lot of discussion of the last season of Mad Men. Joining me now to talk about this year's version of Modern Phoenix Week is Allison King. She's the founder of ModernPhoenix.net, which produces the event in partnership with the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art. Allison, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what is Modern Phoenix Week? For people who aren't familiar with it or haven't been before, what is it?
Well, it's a 10-day celebration of the mid-century modern design heritage here in Phoenix, Scottsdale, and the Greater Valley. Historically, our focus has been on modern architecture, but we also extend that to all of the design and arts, like fabric design, graphic design. Occasionally, we featured neon. And so we really want to draw attention to our great mid-century modern design heritage here and give people an opportunity to have access to buildings and experiences that they might not normally have.
Does Phoenix have more mid-century architecture and other design than other cities?
Well, it's hard to compare because a lot of cities haven't done their inventory yet. But I've traveled quite a bit, and I've been to Palm Springs and other modern cities, and I think it's fair to say that we have a very generous stock here in Phoenix, and it's hard to quantify because it's so spread out. Our valley is so sprawling that it might take you 40 minutes to get from one spot to another. So part of the pleasure of my job is mapping all of this out and showing people where they can find modernism right in their own neighborhood.
I think for a lot of people, and by a lot of people, maybe I just mean me, when I think of mid-century modern architecture, I think mostly of Central Phoenix, the Camelback Corridor, and maybe a little bit north and a little bit south of that in sort of the Midtown area. Are there Are there examples of this elsewhere around the valley as well?
Well, your intuition is right that a lot of it is in the Central Core and on the Kemblebeck Corridor and through Scottsdale. But we have modernism out in Mesa, in Tempe, of course, and in the West Valley. Paradise Valley also has great residential modern architecture. So I encourage you to go take a look at the map, and you can kind of see the patterns of development and see the patterns of growth as well of how really that mid-century boom happened, starting in the Midtown Uptown district rather than in the Central Core.
Can we learn anything about either our history, our present, or our future based on the kinds of mid-century buildings that are here and where they are and what functions they've had?
Absolutely. I think that architecture is the closest thing we have to a time capsule or a time machine, really, so that we can walk into these environments and be taken back into a different era. And exploring these spaces tells us a lot about the people who lived in them. It tells us especially about their values that they held dear. And I, as a woman, am particularly interested in looking at the role of women's relationship to the home. And so I'm a fanatic of mid-century kitchens and bathrooms. That's my that's what I look at when I go into mid-century homes. I'm quite fond of all the gadgetry and interesting little amenities that they've put in for the women of the household.
Why do you think it is that, in general, people are so drawn to this era?
Well, I think it's undeniably beautiful. I think that if you have a keen eye for design and you can understand some of the principles and fundamentals of design, you can really recognize that in our architecture and design here in Phoenix. And I think that a part of what characterizes our mid-century design period is this period of optimism. And that really showed through in the uplifting use of light and uplifting use of space in the post-war era. And I think that people today, when they walk into those spaces, they can feel it. And that's an experience that I like bringing to people when I take them into new spaces, is watching their reaction of how they emotionally respond to that environment.
Do you think that, I joked about Mad Men and having discussions about the last season on Modern Phoenix Week, during Modern Phoenix Week. I mean, do you think in any way that has sort of, the popularity of that show has maybe boosted people's interest in, oh, look, there's this house that looks like, Don and Betty Draper might have lived in?
Absolutely. I think that Mad Men did a really great job of broadening people's taste and exposing them not only to the attitudes of the post-war era, but also the design. And there was a recent article, I think, in the New York Times about how one of the lasting legacies of Mad Men was the changing taste of furnishings that people have had, and the desire to have older, more collectible grandma's furniture rather than their parents' furniture. And so I'm quite grateful to Mad Men for bringing that to more people's attention.
Well, I would think that's good for you.
Yeah, it is. It makes my job a whole lot easier.
So are there things that are new this year during Modern Phoenix Week that you haven't done or haven't been able to do in the past?
Well, this year we were able to do an event with the David and Gladys Wright House, which was particularly exciting for my group to be able to bring some people into that space and experience it. It's not often you get to witness the birth of a museum, so we are quite excited to bring people through and to experience the grounds as they're under transition and to figure out for themselves and decide for themselves how we can use this cultural asset as a design center in Phoenix.
How do you think Phoenix and the Valley in general do as far as preserving some of these buildings, either, commercial buildings, office buildings, or homes, as far as making sure that, A, they're not torn down, and B, that they're not updated so much that you forget the time in which they were built?
Well, it's true. We have a lot of mixed results in that department. We have had quite a few losses of important bank buildings and civic buildings and commercial buildings and, of course, private homes that we've lost in the last few years. And on the other extreme, there has been a lot of modification of these homes in particular to turn them into something that they weren't really intended to be. And I really, for my own personal taste, I prefer those that are more intact but updated for contemporary living. But what part of my philosophy in holding Modern Phoenix Week is to let people decide for themselves and to motivate them to make choices themselves and be responsible stewards of this era.
What do you think is the balance between maintaining a mid-century modern building and also having it so that it functions in the 21st century? So you're not, using some of the kitchen gadgets that maybe don't really work so well anymore, or just aren't convenient.
Right. Well, some of the it's true that the kitchens are often the first to go, and bathrooms as well. And I'm sorry, I'm especially sorry when a pink bathroom goes. Every time a pink bathroom dies, you know. but in many instances, it can't be avoided. And I think particularly as it relates to home ownership, these small mid-century homes were not really designed to be worked in like we work today. Almost everybody that I know who's an adult, a young adult, has a home office of some kind because of the way that we work. And needing to have a media center or a place that we can connect and focus.